coming up on Weekend America.
The big automakers need inspiration. Maybe Jack Kerouac can help.
So Dean and I raced on to the East Coast, beating hotshot passenger trains and steel wheel freights in one nervous, shuddering snap-up of the gas. There were hobos, wino bottles, the moon shining on wood fires.
We're looking for the most awesome American car. I'm John Moe. Also, America is where everyone else in the world wants to be, right?
When I came, I want to stay here for 2 years, but I'm just here 9 months, and I want to go quick back to Brazil.
Some immigrants decide it was better back home. And as the holidays approach, groceries matter.
And when that husband comes in, knowing that his football starts at noon, and he's got a list and it says sweet potatoes on it, he better not go home with a yam.
Turns out yams and sweet potatoes are the same thing, except not really. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. 8 degrees yesterday in St. Paul. I moved here last spring, so this whole Minnesota winter thing is new to me, and I had heard about it, but man, I'd been biking into work for a long time, but after a while, last week, I noticed that no one else was biking, and I started getting these crazy headaches, which I think was from my skull freezing. Yeah, I'm done biking for a while. I can tell you guys about this because you're all over America. I whine to people here about it, and they just shake their heads and they say, oh, just you wait. And then I cry a little. I think I'll buy a new coat this weekend. What are you doing this weekend?
I'm working and going skiing.
Well, I'm going to church on Sunday.
I will be going to the Denver Bronco football game on Sunday when we play the Raiders.
This weekend I'm going to go over to a friend's house. We're going to do some serious rock banding, and then we're going to play some board games.
This weekend I'm actually playing a few gigs. Saturday I'm in Troy. And Sunday, I'm back here in New York City at the Brecht Forum.
I'm preparing to go to Iowa to spend Thanksgiving with my lovely sister and her family.
You know what? We're just here in Chicago for the week on vacation.
I love that woman who said that we're playing the Raiders in Denver. I love the use of the first person plural. She's going to put on a helmet, take on the Raiders. In Detroit, the big three automakers are heading back to the drawing board. They were unable to convince Congress to give them $25 billion in bailout money, at least not right away. Congress has given them a December 2nd deadline to come up with details on how that money would be used to avoid bankruptcies, plant closures, and layoffs. So the automakers are going to have to get creative. They're going to have to innovate, to redesign and reimagine the way that they do things, the way they do business. As always, we're here to help. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark has been asking Americans from different walks of life how to reimagine the American car.
Because, let's face it, American car makers have more than just the economy to worry about. Equally important is making American cars awesome again. Get out your whiteboards for a massive blue sky brainstorm in a minute. But first, we should take stock. Remember how much we loved our cars in the good old days?
Futurami is a brand new word created to describe this brand new post-war General Motors car.
It will be your magic carpet.
She's got a competition clutch with the four on the floor.
Presto, no clutch pushing. Just step on the gas and
you're working harder than ever. You need a truck that does too. Meet the all-new Ford F-150. It throws an even longer shadow.
But that long shadow is shrinking. Just this year, the Ford F-150 truck, the one that works as hard as you do, ended its 17-year reign as the best-selling vehicle in America. It lost out to not one, but four small, fuel-efficient Japanese cars, the first time ever that the most popular automobile in America was not designed by an American company. The crisis was summed up neatly by Ford CEO Alan Mulally on the floor of Congress this week.
Is there a competitive and sustainable future for our domestic automobile industry?
It's not like the auto industry hasn't been trying. Detroit rolls out new features and new lines all the time, from airbags to GPS navigation systems to a prototype for a hydrogen-based Hummer with algae-filled panels that pump oxygen back into the atmosphere. There may not be a single product more obsessively designed and redesigned than the American car. And still,
it's a challenging period right now.
The companies are flailing.
But I got to tell you, it's one of the most exciting periods in the auto industry. It is just bringing the creativity out in all of our people.
Ed Welburn is trying to stay optimistic. He's the vice president of global design for General Motors, and he has one big hope.
I can't think of anything more exciting than the development of the Chevrolet Volt.
That's GM's long-awaited electric car. It's pretty cool. It gets the equivalent of about 80 miles per gallon, and an average commute is supposed to cost about $1 a day. A model is on display at the LA Auto Show this weekend, though to save costs, GM didn't send any top execs to promote it. The Volt will help revive GM when it hits the market in 2010, if the company can avoid collapse before then. But the Volt's not going to save Detroit by itself. Foreign automakers are gaining more market share every year, and U.S. companies have to make enough money to support elaborate management structures and expensive labor contracts. American carmakers don't just need to stay competitive, they need to be transcendent. They need to tap untapped markets with their fantasticness. So maybe it's time to go far and wide, to look for automotive inspiration in places you might not think to look, like the driveway of a woman who avoids driving American cars in favor of
a 1994 Volvo 940 station wagon, and it has 170,000 miles on it.
You may have heard Amy Hungerford on this show before. She's a panelist on our segment Good News, Bad News, No News, and a professor of literature at Yale. She's a self-proclaimed liberal East Coast Volvo driver. You know the type. And if she can come up with a way for Detroit to reach her crowd, then we're getting somewhere. So what does she want?
A Kerouac.
Jack Kerouac.
It even has the sound like a Pontiac, a Kerouac. I like that a lot.
Okay, it's a stretch, but so were limousine Hummers, and they caught on, sort of. Amy wants to drive an American car that feels real, like Jack Kerouac must have felt driving through America in his book On the Road.
So Dean and I raced on to the East Coast, beating hotshot passenger trains and steel wheel freights in one nervous, shuddering snap-up of the gas. There were hobos, wino bottles, the moon shining on wood fires. There were white-faced cows out in the plains, dim as nuns.
It would have to have big windows so that you can stare out back and eye the receding scenery of the land. A lot of cup holders, definitely. A lot of cup holders.
This wouldn't be a PT Cruiser version of an old car. It would be more bare bones, more straightforward, maybe. Amy sees former Volvo drivers rushing to their nearest Kerouac dealer to share a ride with the ghosts of Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty. But that's just the beginning.
You know, you might have to have a whole sort of library of America of cars. You could have the Cheever. This would be sort of John Cheever's suburban cars in which you kind of make a pass at the babysitter. That would be the Cheever.
And there would be the O'Connor, or maybe the Flannery sounds better. A big boat of a car with a plank of wood for a seat, like in the novel Wiseblood. Okay, maybe a wood seat is not the safest feature, but you definitely feel more connected to the road. And then there could be another car called the Pynchon.
If you follow Oedipa Moss from Thomas Pynchon's Crying of Lot 49, she stops her car on a bluff overlooking the pattern of lights in the city, and she has this religious experience. She feels like she's at the center of a slowly moving hurricane wind circling around her. And I think it's when the car brings you to that mystical place, that's what's going to reinvigorate the American relationship to the car.
At least it could make a really good car commercial. Next up on the brainstorming tour, Silicon Valley. I call up Google and talk to Richard Walker, an engineer who moved there from Michigan. He says, Detroit, beware.
The brightest things and the newest things come out of Silicon Valley. I don't mean to be too egotistical about it, but this is the home of innovation in the United States.
Richard works on Google's Recharge It project, which is trying to make hybrid plug-in cars more popular. But Richard also has simpler dreams of what could make cars cool again.
Like installing a miles per gallon meter in every car. Study after study has shown that just being aware of the fuel economy that your car is getting at any point in time makes you more efficient when you drive.
Here's a new contraption that tells you exactly how many miles you get to the gallon. A gas gauge that mounts right on the windshield to test gasoline mileage on your car.
Sometimes the best innovations have already been invented, but forgotten. That ad was for a long-abandoned feature in a 1935 Chevrolet. I tell this to Richard.
I'll send you the link to it. It's really cool.
Wow. I had no idea that back in the day, this was even an issue. I thought this was a recent development, sort of, wow, we finally care about fuel. Let's go think about fuel economy.
Richard had other schemes for making cars awesome again.
My dream is for my car to drive me. I don't want to operate my vehicle. I want to kind of get into the car on, say, a lazy Saturday afternoon and say, take me to the movie theater. And then you punch in the address a lot like you would punch in the address on your personal GPS. And then it will drive me onto the road, avoid traffic, obey traffic laws.
Meanwhile, you could sit back, read up on what movie to see, write an email to your mom. In fact, the windshield could double as a computer screen. You could double-click on things that you see as you drive by.
Like if you see a parade going by, you could look up what the parade was right there. Think about all the things you think about or daydream about while you're driving that kind of catches your eye, and you're like, oh, I wonder what that is.
I take some of these ideas back to Ed Welburn, the GM designer, and he listens politely. Then he manages my expectations.
The reinvention of an automobile is that takes time. I mean, there's so many things. There's so much that's there right now that I think the world just needs to stop, take a look at, and get a better understanding of.
I mean, these cars are sweet.
Lolita Hernandez worked at a GM plant for 32 years. Her pension and her pride are directly connected to the Cadillac engines she used to make.
I'm always so incredibly angry that people think that U.S. automakers are not producing good cars, and they really are. We're at such a crux right now that to say that there's an innovation that's going to pull everything out is crazy. Automakers are being blamed for credit problems. People would be out here buying these cars if they had the credit.
Lolita is optimistic, but she's also prepared for the worst. In some ways, she's been watching the American auto industry as she knew it die a slow death for years. Lolita's also a writer, and when the Cadillac plant that she worked at closed in 1994, this is what she wrote.
If you have a mother or father dying slowly, you see them diminish. The end is coming. You should be prepared. But when your loved one crosses that nodal line from which there is no return, you are still in shock. You still grieve. What should the preacher say then? The soul of the dearly departed has risen and is in the lap of the Lord. Take comfort in that, my children. Or should we, the children of that big-lapped General Motors mama, say, adios, viejito. You are one bad, bad, bad mama jamma.
There is one innovation she says she'd like to see on GM cars, a new hood ornament with the words universal health care spelled out. I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
So how about you? What would you do to make American cars awesome again? Tell us your ideas. Go to weekendamerica.org. We want to hear about all your plans. Crazy plans, welcome. Check out our website and the story, The New American Car. Leave your comments in the comments section.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
For the person committing the act, suicide is the end. For those left behind, it's just the beginning. Next on Weekend America. Thank you. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Today is National Survivors of Suicide Day, a day meant to acknowledge and support those left behind in the wake of a suicide. Conferences are being held all over the country. More than 32,000 Americans die by suicide every year, and it's the third leading cause of death among 15 to 24-year-olds. With each death comes a world of pain, anger, and confusion for people who knew and loved the deceased. Doug Merrill lives in Bowling Green, Ohio, south of Toledo. He has survived the suicides of 8 people, most of them teenagers in his community. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper went to hear his story.
Doug Merrill has spent his entire life in Bowling Green. His fondest childhood memories are of playing wiffle ball in the front yard and of Dawn, the girl he fell in love with in 7th grade.
She kicked me in the shin first, and then when I saw her later, I just did a shoulder bump. And it was kind of our way of saying, hey, I like you.
Doug and Dawn were buddies through high school, going to dances and singing in the choir together. They thought they'd be friends forever. But in May of 1987, all that changed. Out of the blue, one of Doug's wrestling teammates killed himself. At 16, Doug took it hard. Dawn took it harder. A few days afterwards, they were on the school bus when Dawn asked whether their friend had gone to hell.
My answer to her haunts me to this day, and even now I'm having a difficult time telling you. I looked her straight in the eye and I said, no, Dawn, I don't believe Kevin's in hell. I believe that when it's our time to die, that we will see and speak to Kevin the same way you and I are now.
Why is it difficult for you to remember what you said to her then?
Because we were having two different conversations, and I didn't realize that. So in my attempt to make her feel better, what I was actually doing was being used by her to remove that last hurdle of doubt of something that she had already wanted to do.
Later that day, Dawn hanged herself. Doug was past grief. He was angry.
If she didn't want to be a part of my life, then I don't want to be a part of hers. I did not attend her visitation. I did not attend her funeral service. In many ways, I wiped her memory from my mind.
At school, he yelled at a student who was lowering a flag in Dawn's honor. He didn't want anyone to glorify her suicide. The staff noticed, and they put him into counseling. He wasn't happy about it. He was worried that the other students would either think he was crazy or just trying to grab attention. But it was in counseling that he revealed his secret.
I really had not spoke with anybody about the conversation that I had with Dawn the day before. To be honest with you, in my mind of a 16-year-old, I wasn't 100% sure that I had not done something legally wrong, and I felt responsible in some ways for killing her.
Counselors assured him that he'd done nothing wrong, but still, Doug could not forgive himself. He kept those feelings bottled up for years. Then, when Doug was 20, a friend died in a car crash, and he just couldn't take it. He drove to southern Ohio, left a goodbye note in his car, and then he stood on a cliff preparing to jump. When a stranger happened to walk by, he lost his nerve. Instead, he went to visit his friend's grave. At the cemetery, he stumbled over something.
And when I stopped to see what I had tripped on, I turned and then I saw this name, and I saw Dawn was right here.
Here's the thing. He didn't even know that she was buried there. Remember, he'd refused to go to her funeral. But now he was face to face with the anger that he'd carried all those years. And that's when he spoke to what he calls the demons of suicide.
I stared down those demons. I said to myself, you know, you almost got one more, but you lost, and you're going to continue to lose.
Four years later, Doug was back at his old high school, this time as the baseball coach.
Some of these trophies were back when I was an athlete. And what even makes it more special is some of them are here during the years that I was a coach.
Things were going well until April of 2004. That's when an assistant coach reprimanded a baseball player, Derek, for chewing tobacco. Derek went home, and just like Dawn, he hanged himself.
After Derek's death, I started to get angry. Because I just didn't understand.
That's Caitlin Lancier. She was Derek's ex-girlfriend. The school provided counseling for Caitlin and for other students. In fact, it implemented an action plan that's like a page out of a Homeland Security playbook. All threats are taken seriously. All freshmen are given training on preventing and detecting depression, and all of the counselors are experienced crisis managers. Still, the suicides kept happening again and again. Between 2004 and 2007, 4 students at Bowling Green High School killed themselves. There were 3 other attempts in a single week. The principal, Jeff Dever, could not believe what was happening.
When your community has a suicide, there are statistics that show that there will be suicide reverberations. The chances are you'll have more. The window usually is anywhere from 5 to 6 years long. And so we're about a year out from that original suicide, and hopefully we'll be okay.
Welcome to Alpha Z Delta. Would you like to see a tour of the house?
Sure.
Okay.
That's Caitlin again. She was the student who had dated Derek, one of the most recent suicides. She's now at Bowling Green State University. Last year, she even joined a sorority.
Hi. I was happy as can be. Everyone around this house kind of just knew me as Caitlin, the bubbly, happy-go-lucky girl.
But just like Doug, her anger came back to haunt her.
In the middle of February, I absolutely lost it. I fell into severe depression.
She did not embrace anything that life had to offer any longer.
Doug ran into Caitlin earlier this year.
But the biggest sign was the fact that she just flat out told me,
"Doug, I don't see a reason to wake up anymore. I just don't want to do it. I'm over it."
That definitely catches your attention, so I told on her. Her parents were able to get involved.
I think he stepped in at the perfect time. I've been healthy, I've been happy, and that's just my biggest fear, is feeling like that again.
Doug realizes that the battle against suicide is never ending, but he has a secret weapon for his fight. He shared it with me as he pointed out the house where his friend Don used to live.
I purposely run past this house 5 times a week, and every time I do, I hold my index finger and my thumb out, and it makes the shape of an L, and that stands for live. So every time I run by this house, I give that symbol, just to let that demon know that I know about him, and he's going to lose.
In Bowling Green, Ohio, I'm Desiree Cooper for Weekend America.
Doug Merrill now travels the country talking about depression and suicide prevention. This weekend he's in Clearwater, Florida, speaking at a suicide awareness event called Out of the Darkness. He's also written a book about his experiences, Fighting the Demon of Suicide. There's more about Doug and Bowling Green at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
Jessie loves the night at the disco. She gets dressed up, goes to the club, covers herself in mirrors, and dangles over the dance floor. The human disco ball, ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. It's time for your letters. 2 weeks ago, we ran a story on California's Proposition 8, a ballot measure amending the state constitution in order to ban same-sex marriage. Several listeners wrote in expressing strong opinions about it and complaints about the other side. We got letters about pushy religionists on the one hand and about the gay agenda on the other. But listener Peter Woodbury of Chula Vista, California, wanted to say that not everything is as black and white as church versus gay.
Just once, I would like a reporter to mention that there are established churches in this country which do not take such a literalist view of the Bible and therefore are comfortable supporting gay and lesbian marriages. In an era when the Episcopalians of New Hampshire can select a gay bishop, it ought to be pointed out that there exists a vital, although minority religious community that is more liberal and supports equal rights for all people.
The weekend after Election Day, we asked some folks what songs were going through their heads post-election. And then we asked for your songs on our website, and we got a ton. So, here you go. We jammed in as many of your picks as we possibly could. You ready? Our listeners' favorite election season songs, summing up their moods. Thank you, musical listeners. I'm going to be humming that all day. And finally, on a recent show, a couple of recent shows actually, I wondered out loud, what's the deal with buckles on pilgrims' hats? Why would a hat need a buckle? Well, Michael Turin from Boston suggested this answer. He says, at some point in the 1720s, buckles on hats were a fashion, just a fashion, useless, there for no good reason except to attract a mate or similar, and probably not all that good at that. So when a painter in 1840 decided to portray someone as looking old-fashioned, he decided to portray him as wearing a buckled hat. Thanks, Michael. Just mere ornamentation. If you have anything to say about hat fashions or any other Week in America topic, let us know, weekinamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The lousy economy hits everyone in America in different ways. But a Pew Hispanic Center report shows that immigrant incomes are falling faster than others. For some, that's tipped the scale and they're leaving. Is America no longer the land of opportunity? There's no reliable snapshot of how many immigrants are going home, but in the Boston area, Weekend America's Kara Oler talked to one immigrant group that's shrinking fast.
The Boston area is spotted with little Brazils, but they're getting littler every day.
How do you know that I'm going back to Brazil?
It's not sad.
That's 22-year-old Julie Gonzalez. And last week, she worked at a Brazilian-run optical store. But this week, she's going back to Brazil for good.
When I came, I want to stay here for 2 years, but I'm just here 9 months, and I want to go quick back to Brazil.
Julie's ambitious. She graduated from college and came to the U.S. with expectations of higher paychecks and maybe a little excitement. She says she would have stayed if it weren't for one thing.
The economy here is not good. The things is really expensive, and in Brazil it's better now. And so that's why I buy United States.
Some estimate nearly 200,000 Brazilians live in Massachusetts. But for Julie and many others, the sacrifices made to be here aren't making as much sense these days.
Hi, everybody. This is Fausto da Rocha. Good morning. The theme of our show today is going back to Brazil.
Fausto da Rocha sits in a cramped studio in the basement of a strip mall church in Quincy, Massachusetts.
Are you returning to Brazil? Or are you going to stay?
Fausto runs the Brazilian Immigrant Center and hosts this show every week. Today's topic is tying up the phone lines.
Hey, hi, Fausto. This is Norton. Yeah, many of my friends, they already left. And other friends are going back this month and next month. One is Marcelo. Yeah, Marcelo. He already bought his ticket. He's counting the hours.
Fausto estimates nearly 10,000 Brazilians are leaving Massachusetts this year. Brazil's economy has improved. But people are also scared to live here in the U.S. without a visa. Fausto says Brazilians endured oppressive military rule for 24 years. But in his opinion, what they're starting to face here is worse.
The immigration start arrest more and more people, and that makes people start has a nightmare, because sometimes you just wake in the morning, someone knock your door, and you open the doors, the immigration came and arrest everybody.
Day-to-day life for undocumented Brazilian immigrants involves a lot of risk. Take Luis. He's been here 4 years and delivers pizza. Just 2 weeks ago, a cop pulled him over. He got lucky, and the cop let him go. Working here, he can pay for his family to live in Sao Paulo in a house with a swimming pool. He says he only has $3,000 to go, and he'll own the place. But last week, his wife called. They had a deal. 4 years. That's it.
My wife asked, hey, Luis, I need you to be here in February. You stay in America 4 years. Your children cry every day. I don't have a choice. I have to go.
Luis doesn't want to. And he's worried.
I talk to God and say, God, please help me. Because if I go to Brazil, I can't pay everything. Because in Brazil, I'm older man, 44. Companies say, hey, you older man, I don't have a job. The first time when they America, I saw the older man working. I cry because the Brazil never.
Luis is scared that without the money he makes in Boston, he'll have to move his family to a dangerous part of Sao Paulo. What he'd like is to bring them here. But for now, he's headed back. A deal's a deal. Across town in Everett, Massachusetts, there's a restaurant called Sal e Brasa. That's Portuguese for salt and charcoal. There I meet Jojo.
Would you like a beer or something?
Yeah.
He says things used to be good here. Really good.
2 years ago, you used to get here 7 o'clock. You wait outside for at least 50 minutes in order to get a table. That many Brazilians was here on this place.
It's kind of hard to believe that this place used to be so packed. It's totally empty. The buffet island in the middle of the restaurant is full of food, and the same 3 guys have been rotating on the karaoke machine for the last 5 songs. Jojo's been here for 20 years. He's a citizen and drives limos. But this whole economic mess has him thinking.
For the last 3 months, I've been to the end for me. I'm in a mood to sell my little business. Because, you know, for the moment, American Dream is really not real.
There are still a few Brazilians left in the restaurant, and they belt out the song Massachusetts. Jojo says he tries to be an optimist, but he understands why thousands of Brazilians are packing up and going home.
Because right now I'm just a slave for what I'm doing. Just a slave. So, like, for the moment, I'm sorry, America is not a dream for anyone.
In Everett, Massachusetts, I'm Kara Oler for Weekend America.
I will remember in Massachusetts.
Anne Hepperman helped produce that story. If you see a community near you changing because of the economy, we want to hear about it. Let us know at our website, weekendamerica.org. Today we are revisiting our Weekend Shift series, stories about people for whom this is not a time to relax, but a time to go to work on the weekend. You know, waiters and waitresses, cashiers, cops, public radio hosts, I suppose. But sometimes, as we've been putting this series together, we run across a job that is not as normal as all those, a job that is very different from any other job ever. Reporter Lauren Kirby came across a job just like that one recent night while out dancing in Portland, Maine. She saw Jesse Sorrentos, and Jesse was hanging from the ceiling. She was a human disco ball. Lauren met up with Jesse to find out how she wound up there.
Around 9 p.m., Jesse Sorrentos arrives in the back dressing room at Styx Nightclub to begin her transformation from human to human disco ball.
The glitter dust, we want it to be completely covering me. And
with a flat palm, she smears glitter across her bare abdomen and then shimmies into some itty-bitty sparkly briefs.
I look like some fantastical science fiction fairy.
Then she pulls out a reflective scrap of spandex that looks like a tube top made for a Cabbage Patch Kid, finagles it over her slight shoulders, and pulls it down until it covers her chest.
Little itty-bitty jewels that I wanted to glue onto my face. This is one trick I learned from drag queens. Put them on with tweezers and a little rub, a little more glitter. I think we're good to go. Are you coming?
We weave through the bowels of the club, past Mardi Gras decorations and Christmas lights.
Secret passageway, so we can...
And in a flash of silver, Jessie disappears onto her platform, snaking long strands of silk around her tiny arms and kicking her legs into the air.
I'm spiraling down from the ceiling hanging by silk, and I spin over everybody's heads, and I love it. It's like flying.
Jessie found the job as the human disco ball by answering a Craigslist ad, which, after watching her perform, I'm guessing read something like, "Wanted." A very sparkly cross between a figure skater and a contortionist, open to body paint instead of wardrobe, formerly employed by Cirque du Soleil. But who has those credentials? What makes someone think, human disco ball, that's perfect for me?
I started stripping when I was 17 to go to college for performing arts.
That's right. Jessie started out as a stripper. She worked in Las Vegas, Montreal, and Fort Lauderdale. But she felt like a sellout. She knew there was an artist, a true performer, inside of her that wasn't being recognized. Until one day, truly out of the blue, it was by a petite Russian woman at a club called Sharks in Daytona Beach.
She goes, "Oh, God, what's your name?" And she says, you real dancer. You know how I know? Moscow Ballet, me, 15 years, prima ballerina.
Jessie doesn't want to name this Russian ballerina because Sharks is a pretty sleazy club. But she will tell me that she idolized her as a child.
It was an epiphany, and it just was like, you know what? I don't have this in me anymore. I can't be like this. And I started the slow journey home back to Maine, and this is where I'm at today.
At last call, Jessie slips out of her silks and heads back to the dressing room to begin the long process of transforming herself from human disco ball back to just plain human. And although she looks drained, she looks happy.
I really feel like a performer, and that's that piece of magic that really feeds your soul.
Jessie's using many of the same skills she was using in her stripping days, except now she feels redeemed as a performer. Sometimes you find redemption where you least expect it, and sometimes redemption's messy. In this case, it's also sparkly.
If you've ever tried to get glitter off your skin, it's impossible.
Like reflector shield sparkly.
Look how black the water is. And that never ceases to amaze me.
In Portland, Maine, I'm Lauren Kirby for Weekend America.
You can find Jessie Sorrentos in all of her sparkliness at Styx Nightclub in Portland, Maine tonight and pretty much any weekend. If you can't make it out to the club, try the photos at our website. Looking at them now. Oh, there she is, spinning around. She loves the nightlife. She has to boogie. That's at weekendamerica.org. Attention new Obama administration appointees. Here's a Washington, D.C. weather forecast. Clear, sunny, high of 38. As for you, Senator Clinton, it sounds like you'll be traveling a lot, so just pack for all kinds of different climates, okay? With a look at weather and fun for the rest of us, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Parades are fun, but busting your butt preparing a parade is so much more fun. At least Stamford, Connecticut hopes you believe that during their Giant Balloon Inflation Festival. 40 and sunny to blow up giant balloons and help build floats. Sure, you might hit your thumb with a hammer working on a float, but the upside? Enough helium to give you a cartoon voice for weeks. This time of year, everyone's talking about Santa Claus, but whither the cowboy, asks Jasper, Texas. They're reminding kids that cowboys deserve year-round attention with Cowboy Campfire. 58 and sunny to learn cowboy songs, shoot cans with pop guns, and ride stick horses. Real horses will not be attending. They, and Santa's reindeer, are at the We Actually Do All the Work symposium. Outdoor ice skating is usually associated with freezing climates, but Santa Monica, California wants to free ice from the tyranny of cold weather with its own outdoor ice rink. 75 degrees and sunny to, I'm not kidding, ice skate and sunbathe at the same time. Also to watch beach bunnies figure out what to do on a sheet of frozen water. Nothing good can come from combining bikinis and ice skates. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
You know how it is around the holidays. Families get together. Small arguments turn into major battles. Gets ugly. Yams versus sweet potatoes, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Are you cooking for Thanksgiving? It's only a few days away, you know. You got to make the bird perfect. Make the stuffing that everyone likes and not the one that everyone thinks is gross. You remember which one is which, right? You sure? Hey, do you have enough wine? I mean, no pressure or anything. Yeah, there are lots of issues when it comes to Thanksgiving food, and there are controversies. Weekend America producer Ocean Kalin looked into one of the biggest holiday food sticking points.
I was hanging out with my buddy Pete the other day.
My name's Pete Thomas, and I work
in a grocery store in the produce department.
And he started telling me about the stress he sees in the produce aisle on Thanksgiving. And it's usually some guy.
And when that husband comes in, knowing that his football starts at noon, and he's got a list and it says sweet potatoes on it, he better not go home with a yam, because no football for him.
Now, it's not just husbands. This might be your first Thanksgiving with the in-laws, or you might be trying to help out, but you don't want to screw things up. Well, Pete says this worry reaches its apex right in front of the sweet potatoes and yams.
The box they come in says yam. The sign that we put out says yams. But they are sweet potatoes. And the only people that we have to talk off the ledge, as it is, are people that say, where are the sweet potatoes? You point to the sign that says yams, and you say, those are sweet potatoes. They go, no, they're not. Yes, they are.
So apparently sweet potatoes and yams are the same thing. But at Pete's store, they actually carry four different kinds of sweet potatoes.
A garnet, a jewel, sometimes Japanese. And then we also carry something that is called a Jersey sweet.
So there are different varieties of sweet potatoes. Some of them are called yams, but that's wrong. And different stores call different ones different things. And if that weren't confusing enough, there's this whole other vegetable that's actually a yam, a real yam. And it's called a yam.
A true sweet potato and a true yam are different, completely different botanically. They are different genus, different species.
That's Jessica B. Harris. She's a cookbook author, food historian. She knows about true yams.
They tend to have a brown skin, almost like a white or Irish potato, and in some cases maybe fibrous on the outside. Their taste is more like the taste of a potato than of a sweet potato.
Can you buy true yams?
Oh, absolutely. But the thing is that you buy them in Hispanic markets where they're called ñame.
Okay, so I got to keep this straight. So what Pete sells me is a sweet potato, no matter what he calls it. Down the street at the Mercado, if it's called a yam, it might be a true yam. Or it might be a sweet potato, who knows. So somewhere, some weird switch-up happened. And Jessica Harris says it started with the slave trade.
One of the things that we don't really think about is that that kind of forced movement of masses and masses and masses and virtually unthinkable numbers of people also necessitated feeding them. And so provisioning the slave ships was a big deal. And they left with certain kinds of provisions from Europe, but they also provisioned themselves on the African coasts. And one of the things that they were provisioned with were yams.
So when Africans arrived, they looked for yams.
There weren't any. But there was this other thing.
The sweet potato.
A sweet potato.
So whites call them sweet potatoes, African Americans call them yams, cultures get blended, 3 centuries later we're dumbfounded in the produce aisle. So which one do I get for Thanksgiving? I still don't get that one. So I called up author and chef Zoe Francois, who went to a few markets, picked up anything called a yam or sweet potato, and headed back to the kitchen to sort it out.
We have garnet yams and jewel yams, which both of those are actually sweet potatoes, and that's what most Americans will find in the grocery store. Then we have this giant, it's called a camote. This one's from Mexico. Then the two that are real yams are the purple yam that we found at the Asian market and the yampy yampy.
We cooked them as simply as we could, just washed them, pricked the skins, and baked them so that what we were tasting was just sweet potato and yam. So first, sweet potatoes.
Let's cut into it and we'll see what the flesh looks like. And it has this sort of yellow, tan flesh to it. What do you think? Will it be...
It was fine. You know, the thing is, I've never had a sweet potato before, so for me, this was new. You know, it tasted like a potato, except kind of sweet. We tried the rest of the sweet potatoes.
Okay. It tastes surprisingly different.
Yeah.
Then we tried the true yams.
Okay. It's really sweet.
They all had their own distinct taste.
That's interesting.
But here's the thing. Zoe baked 2 different desserts with 3 different kinds of sweet potatoes and yams, and they all kind of tasted the same. I mean, they were great, but I couldn't quite tell the difference between them.
Once I added the cream and the ginger, and I even didn't add that much spice to them because I wanted the flavor to come through. Even then, I just can't taste the difference.
So I asked Zoe, what should people do in the produce aisle when they're forced with that decision?
I think if people are stressed out about which potato to get, they really just should relax and enjoy their Thanksgiving. I don't think it's going to make a difference.
In Minneapolis, I'm Ocean Kalen for Weekend America.
We've got links to a few great sweet potato recipes, that's sweet potatoes, at our website, weekendamerica.org. And that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Hey, have you ever noticed how much a part of the show you are? We don't go for a whole lot of movie star interviews here. We're much more inclined to talk to people like you. And if there are any movie stars out there listening, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to prove a point. We like YouTube movie stars, but we're mostly interested in the non-movie stars. We want you to help produce the shows. You're a big part of this. You are the Weekend America content army. Maybe we'll print up some uniforms later on, or at least like some satin tour jackets or something. Now, the easiest way to help us with stories is to go to weekendamerica.org. The site is full of stories we're working on where we could use your help. Now, here are some other ways. If you're on Facebook, become a fan of Weekend America. We keep our Facebook fans updated with what's going on with the show, segments where we could use your ideas, your insight, your voices. And then there's Twitter. You can follow Weekend America's Twitter feed at twitter.com/theweekend. One word. You can download a free podcast of our entire program at weekendamerica.org or at iTunes. I'm John Moe. Get out there and enjoy your weekend, okay? Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence and Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
I'm John Moe. On the next Weekend America, as America travels home for the holidays, we're bringing you a variety of homes and how people got to them. Listen as one family travels out of the projects and into the suburbs.
Grass, nicely paved roads, cut and manicured lawns. And I just remember looking around thinking, where am I?
Find your way home to the radio and join us.